what Rich just demoed and will show people separately in a screencast is how a financial model can be deployed to a server, which acts as a front end to a compute cluster. And it's a pretty smooth and seamless interface for students to be able to use a model that the professor developed, select a basket of securities, run some very intensive computation on them against large chunks of data, and get answers back in an Excel spreadsheet. So it's a nice end-to-end thing from the student's perspective. And as you said, it lets them basically run an experiment using a level of computing power that formerly would have just, well, it's not that it wouldn't have been accessible, but it wouldn't have been as easily accessible to them. Is that a good way to say it?
Yeah, I think in some universities, because the complexity involved in deploying systems like that and acquiring the data, curating that data, a lot of universities don't have this kind of infrastructure in place. And so I think for a whole class of students, this would make it accessible for the first time. For others, it'll make it certainly quite a bit easier.
Yeah. Of course, they don't really need to have this on campus in this internet era, right? They should be able to reach across the net. This is all based on web services, right? So
we actually don't know of any academic-focused service like this that exists. Perhaps we're ignorant and not very well-versed in what's going on there. We've heard from our professors and students who we spoke to that this is something that wasn't available then.
These are not computer science students who are learning about high-performance computing and are learning about writing programs for parallel machines. These are students who are learning about financial modeling, and this is just making the tool available to them that can accelerate that.
Precisely. And that's actually where we see most of our HPC customers who are scientists or engineers or business analysts. They're not computer scientists per se. They're folks who use mathematics, they use statistics, they use differential equations, they use sometimes not even math directly, but applications that encode these mathematical models to do something else, to do research, to do engineering, to do business risk modeling and decision making. And to them, this is just a tool, and they want to use it in the way they use PCs today, which is as transparent, as straightforward as possible.
And what's the actual situation today? I mean, for example, in the case of the covariance model that Rich showed in the demo, if it weren't being done in the way that he showed, how would it be done today, typically?
So you can do something like this from Excel or other statistical packages, R, S+, SAS, MATLAB, on the workstation. So you might have to acquire the data, get it in the workstation, and use your preferred tools for doing this kind of analysis in the workstation.
And wait a long time.
Potentially wait a long time, yeah. Mm-hmm. And might not even be able to get all the data if you want to do a significant amount of data, for example, do it over a year or for a large number of stocks. So it might just become simply impossible to do that. Or they might load this up on a server, but then they would have to figure out how to write an application, how to deploy it out to the server. In many cases, that would be a multi-step process where they'd have to somehow copy the models out to the service. Maybe it's local, maybe it's remotely over the network. Then figure out how to submit the data as part of their request to those models. Then pull the results back and then somehow integrate it into their visual analytics environment. And in fact, this multi-step process is exactly what a lot of our HPC users are running into, is that they're expressing their models and doing the design on their workstation in any number of tools. They do analysis of the results on the workstation visualization, but large-scale computation runs somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
It might be within their organization, it might be across the internet, and this is a very disjointed process. Imagine if today you had to print from a workstation by going to command line, FTPing over to your printer, FTPing a file over there, then telnetting into the printer and doing, LPR in a command line and then trying to pull the error codes back or something like that.
That's exactly what I do.
You're a very advanced user. You probably added Pascal by hand.
I'm only kidding.
But
so there are. I mean, there are clusters out there in academia, and there are people who are doing these things. But I think the point is that it hasn't been woven together in this way.
That's right. And in fact, if you look at, I'd be happy to send you the report in 2004 that came out from the U.S. government that did an assessment of U.S. competitiveness in high-performance computing in response to Japanese Earth Simulator winning the sort of the top crown and the fastest supercomputer. There was a high-end computing revitalization task force that produced a report looking at what kind of applications are being executed now and will be important over the next 20 years. And it came back with four recommendations. And the first one was, and I'm actually quoting it, make high-end computing easier and more productive to use. Mm-hmm. Emphasis should be placed on time to solution, the major metric of value to high-end computing users.
Yeah.
A common software environment that spans desktop to high-end systems will enhance the productivity gains by promoting ease of use with end users.
Yeah.
And that's something that we're starting to see in the HPC community, this focus not on just getting the systems running as fast as possible, but figuring out how the entire workflow of the creative element of the scientific process, which is the engineer and scientist, can be optimized as much as possible, which requires focus on the end user.
So Rich and I talked a little bit about how this particular model that we looked at is in a class that he calls parameter sweep, which he distinguishes from the MPI kinds of distributed applications where there's a lot more chatter going on amongst the nodes. In this case, it's the kind of thing where you can send a batch of data down to a node, it can think about it for a while and give back an answer, and there doesn't need to be much communication in the meantime. And that appears to be the case for which this architecture is optimized.
The architecture is optimized for a broad range of different HPC applications, MPI being one of them. In fact, we have that was the major goal of the first release of our product, Compute Cluster Server 2003, is MPI-style applications. And there's a broad range of them in engineering space, in environmental space, where you're modeling some kind of physical process. You'd use differential equations, or you use a variety of mathematical methods. But the idea really consists of building a mesh or a grid that takes a large physical process or physical body, partitions it, does local computations on localized areas of the overall system, but then has to frequently exchange the data across the boundaries of these areas. Think
yeah.
about a car crash simulation. You know, you might take a hood of a car and partition it in a million different parts, and every part will be computed separately. But as the deformation is happening, the forces need to be exchanged between the parts. Or weather modeling, right? You might partition different geographical areas, but there's a heat exchange that happens across.
Right. So high degree of data interdependence.
Exactly. So when you have an interdependent problem, you use something called MPI for that. And we, in fact, focused with our system on that. We worked with the team at Argonne National Labs that releases open source reference implementation for MPI. We've adopted in our product that open source reference implementation, optimize the performance and security on Windows, and integrate it into the overall stack.
Yeah, actually, I understand that you have an MPI layer in the cluster product.
That's right.
And so I should have been clear about this, but what I'm saying is that the system that we're looking at here, the one which is intended for professors at universities to deploy models for students to experiment with, that is targeting, I think, largely the other class.
Correct. That's what I was going to say. There's a large class of problems that are what's called embarrassingly parallel. And a lot of statistical analysis problems fall into this, that, media rendering, things like that, where you want to be able to do a lot of independent tasks.
Yeah.
And this is what we have here, because every pair of instruments that needs to be compared is an independent task.
Yeah.
And this is, in fact, sort of the easiest type of parallelism, where you really just have a lot of tasks, and what you need to do is spray them across a cluster. And in our product, we have a solution for that makes it much easier to distribute these kind of embarrassingly parallel tasks and makes the job of a programmer who has to start tackling parallelism, but in this sort of easier-to-do manner, much more approachable.
Mm-hmm. So in this case, the task is largely one of mapping the input parameters to a set of work items.
Correct.
Okay. And what are some, outside of the financial domain, what are some other places where this style of computing is going to be popular?
I think we see this in a range of different disciplines. This particular set of examples operate on data coming from some kind of external source, in this case, the stock market. But if you and what it is looking for patterns of correlations between different signals. And in fact, this paradigm is very broadly applicable. If you think about, for example, clinical research, where you have data coming in from hundreds of patients, and a data set might include different parameters about their health condition that's being measured, and what you want to look for is markers for a disease or reactions to a drug.
Yeah.
And so you're doing correlation analysis between these different signals, trying to see which one of them might act as a marker. You might have data coming in from sensors that being deployed nowadays in oil and gas pipelines or oil and gas rigs for safety monitoring, environmental sensors, factories starting to put it on their floors. And so everywhere you have data, scientific instruments producing data, incredible amounts of volume, where you need to deduce patterns in data and help optimize the scientific process of developing models and developing insights in the data, something like this would be incredibly useful.
Hmm. So would you say that this class of what you call embarrassingly parallel problems is kind of low-hanging fruit?
It's extremely low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
So both, and lots of data, and there's another class, it's called Monte Carlo simulation, and that's a method that's used very effectively also across a broad range of industries to be able to statistically explore different scenario paths and being able to do risk analysis and being able to do some kind of a predictive modeling of how a system might behave over time. Again, financial services is an example, insurance, energy, but then things like process management within factories can also employ that, or logistics chains.
Okay. So give us a sense of, in the case of this particular example, what the skill set would be required of the professor to construct this model and make it available to students. I mean, there's a certain amount of .NET programming involved, but I don't know, it might not be that hard.
Rich, do you want to take that
one? Yeah, I think it's a matter of picking the .NET language of choice. And then the development environment choice, which for .NET may be a Visual Studio. The way in which we are making the data available in our central database, which right now is market data available, as we talked about before, is Link. So having an understanding of Link, which for the types of queries we're talking about for these types of applications is fairly basic select statements. So it's very basic database nomenclature, but integrated into the actual language. So you get things like syntax completion and things like syntax checking. So it's actually probably a little bit easier than just creating SQL strings from scratch.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a framework here that you're providing. And so what do I get out of that, right? What is the framework abstract for me as the programmer of this model?
I think what the framework does is it does two things. It in a way forces you to define the interface for your model in such a way that you can easily build an Excel front end in this case to send input into your model and to retrieve output from your model. And it also tells you exactly where you need to do things like, where do I do that splitter or that sprayer, as Kirill talked about before, where you take the entire input of the model and break it up into smaller work items to send to the cluster, and then where do you actually put the actual code to do the covariance calculation, and where do you do the code to do the to do the correlation calculation. So it's very, very much directs the professor of where they need to put their code.
So as a practical matter,
I'm focus on writing their analytics portions and not having to worry about fairly complex skeleton that goes into the workflow of submitting the data to the cluster, partitioning the work across the cluster, accessing the data on the back end, and then performing the final reduction operation. So all that underlying structure that embodies a distributed system or distributed program, which is something that fairly challenging computer science problem, gets encapsulated for them, and they can just plug in their logic that's focused on the problem domain itself.
Right. So in other words, I can focus on doing the pivot tables or, you know, whatever, you know, other apparatus I want to apply to this, you know, maybe even MATLAB or something like that. And which is where I'd be spending my time anyway, or where I'd rather be spending my time.
Exactly.
Yes.
So in the domain, in the domain that you're an expert in, not an underlying vagaries of distributed system and computer science.
So who are the guinea pigs going to be for this?
Our first two universities, University of Washington, which was the model that we demonstrated. Eric Zivotz is a professor we're working with there. And the other university is University of North Carolina on the Charlotte campus.
Okay. And this is happening when? Soon, right?
Yes, over the next couple months.
Okay.
So they're going to teach spring semester, I believe, both of those schools, right?
Yes.
So, Kirill, I know that you have big ideas about where else this can go. Why don't you sort of paint the big picture?
Yeah, I think one of the things that when we started the HPC team at Microsoft, we realized is that HPC is a very actively evolving space where there's a lot of innovation that's happening. At the same time, Microsoft was fairly new to HPC, and without the benefit of 20, 30 years of experience in the space, without a lot of experience running HPC in-house, we felt that we needed to do something cutting edge, or take a step forward in being able to very actively develop expertise and build up advanced understanding of not just HPC technology but HPC usage patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So to do that, we worked with and funded 10 universities worldwide as part of HPC Institute's program that has been super helpful to us. But the other thing we have done is created an internal team as part of our product unit whose mission is to do incubation. And the goal of this team is threefold. The first one is to prototype and demonstrate the end-to-end solutions that our HPC customers really will find beneficial. And what Rich has demonstrated is an example of that, where we don't just focus on the runtime of the models themselves, but we focus on the entire process that the user goes through, from developing their model to submitting it to the cluster, to be able to implement in a very productive fashion the models that run the cluster, to be able to retrieve the data and do some group work and collaboration around that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one kind of leg of this tool. The other one is to help us explore the trend that we see where HPC is becoming more and more data-driven. There is still a world where you take the simulation and sort of run it forward, be it car crash or weather modeling, but a lot of applications where HPC is being used are mining the data for new insights and doing it in computational intensive fashion.
Yeah.
Financial services is one example. That changes the formula of how HPC gets employed. In many cases, becoming impractical to put clusters in the customer locations if you have to be involved with transferring terabytes or petabytes of data around.
Yeah.
And so data repositories starting to act as sort of black holes, if you will, that are pulling computation towards them.
I'm sure this is very true in the climate science area.
Climate area, biology, astronomy, geosciences, everywhere you start accumulating tremendous data sets. And we think that there's going to be a way that Microsoft can provide value to customers in optimizing how these services are built, because there's no established architecture today for this the way you see it in traditional simulation supercomputing.
Jim Gray was always talking about how it was becoming necessary to basically FedEx hard disks around the world because there was no other way to move the data to the computation, but instead what you're proposing to do is move the computation to the data.
And so what we like to do as a second leg is to be able to incubate a few of these high-value data-centric services where we demonstrate, if you will, the best practices for doing that, and while providing access to them for free to the academic institutions for them to be able to do their research better, help us understand what's involved in operating these.
Mm-hmm.
And, potentially Microsoft, we might imagine Microsoft running a few of these services.
Mm-hmm.
The third leg that's very much related to what I just said before is not only prototyping these services and understanding what it takes to build them, but flowing those requirements into the software that we implement so that the customers can do this as easy as possible themselves using the off-the-shelf software we built. Because one of the challenges you see in the world today is that you have this dichotomy between these very large-scale internet services being built, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, and others. But they're sort of in their own world where customers cannot take a slice of that infrastructure and deploy it within their environments.
Yes.
At the same time, we continue building off-the-shelf software that people install in their infrastructure, but we're just now starting to learn what it takes to run services using that software. And so what we're intending to do with this labs environment is to make sure that there's a very tight coupling between the team that runs the service and prototypes them and the team that implements off-the-shelf software, such that we run our services using the products we build,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time make it a turnkey for customers to stand up these services themselves. And
so that's a really key point. So let's just underscore that. What you're saying here is that there are starting to be out in the world a set of what I call intergalactic clusters, right? Which are kind of one of a kind things, you know, and they're non-replicable. And you know, they do interesting and powerful things, but you can only do things with them on their terms. And, you know, your notion is that you want to maintain a two-way street here. You want parity, and you want it to be the case that you can always replicate what's happening in the cloud at your premises if you need to.
Exactly. And use an example. We just talked about the data becoming a major gravitational pull. So imagine if you have an astronomy site that accumulates a petabyte of data. Well, you have an option of trying to figure out how you're going to put it on one of these intergalactic services, but that's maybe not what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's not the most optimal thing. Maybe
mm-hmm.
the most optimal thing is for you to stand up a 1,000-node cluster with each node having a terabyte of disk.
Yeah.
And we want to enable that. Right?
Yeah.
We want to be able to tell our customers, here's how we run these large-scale data-driven HPC services, and here's how within a day or two you can stand up one of these yourself. And so, in fact, what Rich has done with the service he just demonstrated to you. Last week, he went to RENCI, which is the Renaissance Institute in North Carolina, and over a day stood up an equivalent service in their location. So they have the same ability to use SharePoint, Excel, SQL, .NET, Compute Cluster, and now provide a service like this themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, this is, I think, is one of the examples of the sort of software plus services notion that Microsoft is popularized and talking about is this flexibility.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you even see some potential consumer applications for this, don't you?
I'd love for, you know, I think there's incredible excitement that that's possible. If you think about what, you know, search is, what everybody's excited about, is it's really a fairly narrow example of something much broader that humans do is ask questions and seek answers. And as, in the case of search, we can only find answers to questions that have already been answered before or have been written about. Imagine if your questions are about some novel insights about the data. You know, tell me how this stock is correlated with that weather pattern. Or, you know, I'd love to be able to have some of my health information available. Microsoft Health Vault now is starting to accumulate
mm-hmm.
Data from a variety of medical devices, right? Heart rate monitors or blood sugar monitors. You know, I'd love to be able to say, well, how's my blood pressure is correlated with atmospheric pressure or something like that.
Or like maybe a little bit closer to home. What are my survival prospects given the specifics of my situation? And, you know, in light of a large body of information, right? You know, run that query for me. I don't want to just take my doctor's word for it.
That's right. Or help me do predictive analysis on my risks of flooding or a hurricane, not for, you know, U.S. general, but for my house, right?
Mm-hmm.
Given the geographical information that's now available, given the weather information that's available, maybe given a few sensors that I actually install at home
mm-hmm.
and start uploading the atmospheric data around my house, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that becomes very exciting.
It really does.
To enable these kind of applications, you have to enable a platform. And this platform would have to provide data, provide ability to provide, to have this very well curated central data for others to extend it, but also for others to be able to develop applications that run on top of this data and then expose it to the end users. And so what you see in the service that we just demonstrated is a just by a first example of that, where there's data available, there's a developer community, which is the professors, that expose a model to the end users, which is the students in this case. But you can imagine, if you want to roll it forward, something like this being a third-party community of developers who are unleashed on this platform and a set of data, with a reputation system and with a way for them to expose their models of services,
yeah.
And end users who use rich user applications to consume them.
I like it. I do. I like it a lot.
You know, it can, we're talking with one of our guys on our team is an avid sailor. And you know, he always says, how great would that be to be able to take the weather data and then combine it with ocean data and salinity data for Puget Sound and be able to do local models for how does the local weather changes due to freshwater runoff that changes the salinity in the region, right? This is not something that's available from National Weather Service, but you can imagine a dedicated community of sailors and researchers of University of Washington standing something like this up and exposing it to local sailing community, right?
Yeah. Well, thanks. This was, I think this was a really good overview of what you guys were up to.
Thanks a lot.